Well, my special guest today says that it's time for the government to stop kicking the can down the road. Eventually, the can could kick back. It's a pleasure to welcome Dr. Lawrence Kotlikoff in his debut appearance here on the show, professor of economics at Boston University and the author of the Inform Act, focused on improving the welfare of every American. Welcome, Professor Kotlikoff.
Thanks. It's very nice to be with you. Let me just set the record a little bit straight.
Sure.
The Inform Act is a bill that two senators are the authors of. That's Senator Kane, a Democrat from Virginia, and Senator Thune, a Republican from South Dakota. So they're the actual authors. I helped write the bill. The bill was kind of initiated by a millennial group, a youth group in Washington called The Can Kicks Back. These folks, young people, decided that they should have a voice in how they're going to be treated. They started to visit with different offices of the different members of Congress, and they eventually ran into Senator Thune's staff, and they got him interested in what I proposed that they put forward as this bill, which is to require the CBO and GAO and OMB to do honest fiscal accounting, to specify every year what our long-term fiscal gap is. And that fiscal gap is something that economists believe we should be measuring. It's saying how much does the government owe, not just what's on the books, but on everything that's not on the books, just not now and not next year, but throughout time, into the future. What's the present value of all those spending commitments, and how do they compare with the taxes that are scheduled to come in? So what's the difference, all the spending that's projected to be made and all the taxes that are projected to come in? What's our fiscal gap? And that's the true measure of our fiscal debt. And that number is about $205 trillion large right now. The official debt in the hands of the public, in comparison, is only $12 trillion large. So you see that we're hiding most of our bills.
It's very well said, and I appreciate that overview of the Inform Act. You know, your work indicates the current generation could be the first in national history to be actually worse off economically than their predecessors. According to 15 Nobel laureates in economics, all of whom endorsed the Inform Act, could you give us more details now on the fiscal gap measures?
So it takes into account all the spending. It's very simple. It's like double bookkeeping entry. The government has obligations to pay principal plus interest on all the outstanding treasury bonds and bills. That's the official debt, and it has a certain present value, and that's the current 12-point-something trillion of debt in the hands of the public. But the government also has obligations to make Medicare payments, to provide for defense, to pay for the Supreme Court justices' salaries. Has all kinds of obligations, Social Security benefits. These are just as real, in some ways more real than paying off the debt, because you can inflate away the debt. Social Security benefits are indexed inflation. You can't really not pay soldiers and military. So all these things represent obligations out into the future, and they need to all be on the books, and that's what the fiscal gap analysis does. It puts everything onto the books, all the spending commitments, and then it forms the value in the present of those spending commitments, and it compares that with the value in the present of all the taxes that are projected to be paid to cover those commitments. And we use the Congressional Budget Office's long-term alternative fiscal scenario projection. So we're using the CBO's data. They're projecting out 75 years, which we then extend beyond that. When you look at the fiscal gap, it's, as I mentioned, $205 trillion large. That's many times larger than the $12 trillion official debt. It's to come up with $205 trillion to come up with the additional taxes needed to cover all the scheduled spending as projected by the CBO, we need to raise taxes by 57% immediately and permanently, every single federal tax. This is an indication of how bankrupt the country is. We're really talking here about 10.3% of GDP on an ongoing basis that we're short. And this is why the economics profession, if you go to the informact.org, T-H-E-I-N-F-O-R-M-A-C-T.org, theinformact.org, you'll see 1,000 plus economists who've signed up to endorse the bill. You'll see 15 of those are Nobel Prize winners in economics. You'll see George Shultz's endorsement. You'll see endorsements of former heads of the Council of Economic Advisors, former head of the Office of Management and Budget. This is the creme de la creme of the economics profession saying that the government's been engaged in what was effectively fraudulent accounting, and that we need to be telling the truth about our true fiscal position. We're actually in worse fiscal shape than Detroit by quite a degree. I mean, Social Security by itself is in worse fiscal shape than Detroit, if you really look at its situation. So it's not going to help anybody to lie about the future, about the actual fiscal situation. We have to start telling the truth, and that's what all these economists are saying.
The entire GDP, 10 to 15 years of everything produced by every single American and business in this country just to pay these future obligations, and just amounts to an enormous figure that I think it's hard for many people to wrap their minds around.
Yeah, you know, when you start, the country's been promising things to people at the local level, at the city, at the state level, and also at the federal level that they can't cover. This has been one ongoing Ponzi scheme. I define a Ponzi scheme as malfeasant accounting, and certainly Madoff was a master of not revealing the true situation, of providing misleading accounting. Enron did this, but these entities and the people learned this at the feet of Uncle Sam. Uncle Sam has been engaged in this kind of misleading accounting for decades. He's been putting all kinds of obligations off the books. The vast majority of the obligations are off the books. So in economics, we have a very clear prescription of how to do the thing right, and that's called the fiscal gap, and that's what this bill requires the government to start doing at the official level. You know, I can tell you what the fiscal gap is because I can take the CBO numbers and transform them into the fiscal gap. But if the CBO does that and puts it on its website, then the press will start paying attention, the public will start to understand what's going on, and we'll have a change in policy. So the idea here is that the government do it at an official level to guide its fiscal policy using the fiscal gap, the idea being that we need to get the fiscal gap down to zero, because no country can sustain its policies with a positive fiscal gap. You have to pay for what you spend. That's true for any company, that's true for any household, that's also true for any government.
And, you know, as you aptly pointed out, we're looking at a Detroit-style situation, even eclipsing fiscal irresponsibility there nationwide. You know, David Walker, former head of the Government Accountability Office, has been a big proponent and endorsed your work. And he had this to say about your plan. I'm quoting here: in order to make better decisions for tomorrow's Americans, today's elected officials need to have better information. Nevertheless, we look at our U3 number, paints a sanguine picture of the national economy, but our former U6 number looks really unmanageable. How can legislators make informed decisions regarding spending with unreliable information at their fingertips?
They can't, and they've been, you know, they have an opportunity right now. We have now 8 senators who have endorsed the bill, 3 Republican, actually it's 9 senators, 3 Democrats and 6 Republicans. We need to get everybody to talk to their members of Congress, particularly their senators, and say, let's enact the INFORM Act so that we can have an honest discussion about how we're treating our kids. If you look at the endorsements by the 1,000-plus economists and the Nobel laureates, if you know the people like I do who've endorsed this bill, first of all, they're, you know, the very top people in the country. They're not, some are partisan, some are from the right, some are from the left, a lot of people from the center. But this is the fact that you have people from the left and the right joining together and saying this is quite a statement. We've never seen anything like this in economics. We've never had 15 Nobel laureates endorse any piece of legislation. It's never happened. And we've never seen 1,000 economists endorse any piece of legislation, especially people that are so far apart politically. So economists can agree on one thing, which is not to lie to the public about our fiscal position. And that's what they're saying. Stop lying to the public. Start doing honest accounting. And everybody in the country who's listening to this, everybody in the country, everybody who's listening to this radio broadcast can send a letter to the head of the CBO and say, look, 1,000 economists, your colleagues, you're an academic economist, do what these people have asked. Don't wait for a bill to be passed. Just start doing it right now. And let's see if we can get it to happen. But we also need to have the legislation passed. And that requires everybody listening to, if need be, go down to Washington, find your senator, and sit down with your senator or the top members of the staff and say, we want you to endorse this bill. You know, a bunch of kids who were in their 20s went and got this senator to agree to have this bill be drawn up, and now we have 1,000, and, you know, they got in touch with me, and I helped draft it. And now I went to work to get these endorsements, and we had an ad, full-page ad in the New York Times with these 1,000 signatures, endorsements specified back in October. That cost over $65,000. We raised the funds to get that to happen. So things are happening here, but we need everybody to jump on this bandwagon and really just get this law passed.
Well, you know, it's true. Your bipartisan effort here is unusual. I mean, to paraphrase Thomas Jefferson from your website, government plans using the funding term are simply stealing from our children's futures. And I think that's one of the interesting aspects of this INFORM Act. It has the potential to bring bipartisan efforts. I mean, as you already pointed out, the bill was introduced by senators from both parties, and the House of Representatives seems to be embracing it as well. As we wrap up here today, any other aspects of the act that you'd like to share with our listeners, please?
Well, it's not a right-wing conspiracy to cut any programs. It's not a left-wing conspiracy to raise taxes. It's just economists are not fundamentally political. This is the equivalent of the economics profession doing what the physics profession did back in the late 1930s when they got Einstein to write a letter to President Roosevelt warning him that the Germans might be developing an atomic bomb. This is the economist saying, look, we may have a fiscal bomb that we're planning under our kids' future economic future. So let's at least be honest about what we're doing, and let's put everything on the books. And that's what the INFORM Act is all about. So as much help as I can get from your listeners, please give it to me and to yourself and to your kids and get this bill passed.
Now, Professor Kotlikoff, we want to really thank you for taking time from your busy schedule today for us.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Well, Bill Murphy is at the helm of the Gold Antitrust Action Committee, GATA, with Chris Powell working on behalf of investors to expose the powers that be manipulating the precious metals market. Welcome back, Bill Murphy.
Great to be here, Chris. Thank you.
Let's begin the dialogue with the Detroit pension confiscation news. You know, as more details begin to emerge from the beleaguered city, it's now becoming clear that pensioners could expect to lose more than 80% of their benefits. This seems to be a theme that's, you know, starting to snowball as governments become bankrupt around the world and now even in our country. You know, on the surface, it seems somewhat deflationary, but I think that as investors begin to realize that ultimately it's, you know, the people that are going to have to pay for these municipal defaults, the safe haven factor of precious metals could start to, you know, make a comeback. Any thoughts?
Oh, yeah, we had Cyprus and Detroit, and there's concern there what the pension people that put their money in pensions are going to get, and there's some other municipalities and states under pressure, and Illinois is a good example. And this is after all this QE and the government trying to fix things with monetary stimulus, and it's liable to catch up to a lot of people. This has been percolating for some time, and now it's beginning to come to the fore.
I wanted to move on to, you know, the Bitcoin scenario. We saw that digital currency soar from under $5 to over 1,000 in less than a year. I'd like to know what odds you place on a sudden aha moment where investors rush into precious metals, similar to the Bitcoin phenomenon.
You know, first of all, God bless the Bitcoin people for having the audacity and creativity to do what they've done. I know a couple of guys that have been involved in the beginning, and they've made fortunes, and they deserve it. Good for them. And, of course, it's interesting because, you know, lately the government agencies or the SEC, a bunch of people all came out and blessed it. Now, you got to be scary about something like that when, of course, gold's just the opposite. We know what they've done to it with this suppression scheme this year, and it's been a nightmare. And I think at some point, and, of course, their orchestration data has reinforced the negativity at the moment. The sentiment's terrible, but all of a sudden, the bad guys, as we call them, the gold cartels, going to run out of ability to keep the price down with all the gold flowing to China, and the ETF disgorgement is going to run its course. And it's just going to be something where it's going to overtake the supply, and the gold cartel is going to have to retreat again like they did for 12 years, except this time the move up is liable to be violent. When it's going to start, we'll have to see, but it's coming.
You know, and I'd also like your thoughts on the Shanghai Gold Exchange, because, you know, as you mentioned, this raid on gold has just been music to the ears of Asian governments. There's some speculation now. John Ng is one of the latest to speculate that deliveries made on all the gold in Fort Knox worth of metal, 8,600 tons of gold, has been delivered now by the Shanghai Gold Exchange, and it's delivering huge amounts of gold. China consumed, according to one source, 1,700 tons of gold in just the first 8 months of this year. It's very close to the annual gold production in one country, and incidentally, they're also the world's largest producer.
That's pretty well documented now, Chris. I mean, honestly, in our commentary at the Metropole Cafe, through my source, we reported this 5 years before they announced years ago that they had 400 and they bought an extra 450 tons. None of this was accounted for by the establishment gold people, which were totally embarrassed because all they do is make their things match. They don't account for government coming out, gold coming out of the government coffers to suppress the price or anything. So they were stunned. And we've been all over this for years. They were accumulating it through private sources, and I won't get into that, but it's pretty well documented now that all, you know, sorts of tonnage you're talking about is going into China. They've got these different exchanges to deal with. They know what's coming. They know what the United States has done. They know that they have us trapped. I mean, it's stunning that in China there are 14 gold refineries. There are only three in North America. It's unbelievable. They are gearing up to something dramatic. People that know about what's going on behind the scenes in terms of the gold cartel, in terms of the Chinese, know that we're going to go to historic prices and well beyond, and we just got to get through this raid and let it run its course, and then up we go.
Now, I think it's an interesting point, and if we take a look at the newly affluent middle class in China, of course, this is a huge section of the populace, but we hear constantly of shortages for the yellow metal. So all of that metal is flowing somewhere. Also wanted to ask you about the investor love affair we've seen here with equities. Continues as funds flow away from zero-yielding debt and into stocks. However, when this risk play runs its course, huge money flows are likely to shift back to the commodity sector. I'd like to know what you think could trigger such an event.
Well, this is a big pet peeve of mine because if you go over the past 14 months, gold goes down $500 an ounce on QE, and the Dow goes up some 2,500 points on the same news. It's ludicrous. If anything, gold should have gone up more instead of going the other way. So it's a trade that's, again, it's been orchestrated by the gold cartel and allies, and it's worked very well for them, but it's liable to go just the other way. I'm not a stock market guy, but I do feel pretty comfortable that we have an explosion coming in gold and silver, that and, of course, in the shares that correspond to them, and it's going to be quite something. We just got to get through this madness that they've set in motion, and as they set this in motion, as you talked about earlier, you've got countries like the Chinese and other people just saying thank you very much for the cheap gold, and they have it. Believe me, the Chinese know what Gata knows, and I've had three conference calls with a Chinese investment corporation, their sovereign wealth fund. The Russians know what we know. They've come to our conferences. The goal's going to be the big deal in the years to come, and this is just a prelude for what's coming.
And speaking of preludes of what's ahead, I'd like your thoughts on the big announcement from the Labor Department last week. The unemployment rate plunged from 7.3% down to 7%. That's quite a move lower. But if you look behind the headline figure, people are dropping out of the workforce at a record pace. And this is sort of gives you the illusion of a job increase. Take a look at the Bureau of Labor Statistics website. You can see the labor force participation rate has been plunging since 2008. And that's since the Great Recession began, and it never recovered. St. Louis Fed shows a similar chart. We haven't seen levels this bad since the 70s. And I think the severity of the decline is exacerbated. If you look at it over the past six decades, you see there's never been anything like this on record. I'd like to know, you know, what you think this means and portends for the economy and the markets.
The bottom line is they haven't got much bang for all their buck with this QE they put into the system. The velocity of turnover of money hasn't been there. A lot of the money is just going into the market, it appears. And as is pretty well talked about, the average person these days is not doing that well. The rich are getting richer. The banks are doing fine. Wall Street has been knocking them dead. But in terms of the average Joe and Jane, it's not that good a time, and they're falling further and further behind. And I think they're petrified if they stopped printing the money, what would happen? And as you've talked about, so pretty good year. I mean, the corrections in the stock market have been negligible, as everybody knows, and it's liable to set up something dramatic in next year.
It really makes one wonder what's left in their bag of tricks. Have they used up all the ammo in the arsenal? Because ultimately, this is going to require some new quantitative measure that probably no one has yet even thought up. Good news for precious metals investors. And I also wanted to discuss the disconnect between gold and the greenback. I mean, if this truly was a gold bear market, as the bears claim, one would expect to see the dollar soaring. But we're not seeing that. The greenback has been stuck on the lower end of a three-year bear market consolidation. So if the dollar can't sustain a meaningful rally with the metals off so sharply, it would seem to me as though the day of reckoning for the currency can't be far away.
I take the text. It shows you how much the price has been suppressed. The euro's gone up 8 points in the last 14 months, and gold going down $500. So what's the relationship between the gold and the terms of when they want to manipulate the price down? I mean, it hasn't been a thing. Now, I think that could change where they're hitting the wall in terms of how far they can stretch that. So I think the dollar's in trouble, and while it's had no effect on gold the past year, it's liable to have a big effect in next year.
Well, as we wrap up here, would you like to share any contact information with the listeners and any other activities that might be happening at Gottop?
Well, Chris Powell's been doing yeoman work, and we'll have something out again shortly. He's got his secretary treasurer, and you can find what he puts out at Gottop.org. And I have a website in the Metropole Cafe, been doing it 15 years, and people can sign up for a two-week free trial and see if it's of value to them.
Well, hat tip for all the seminal work that you all are doing there.
Thank you, Chris. Anytime.
Well, this week Congress gave approval for a small-scale military operation in Syria, but some analysts are worried that a full-scale military conflict with the U.S. could be imminent. Gerald Celente joins me with his take on the situation and how it might affect the markets. He's the director of the Trends Research Institute. His team produces the Trends Journal. Welcome back, Gerald Celente.
Thank you, Chris.
You know, some media sources are suggesting that a showdown between the U.S. and Syria could lead to a potential conflict there in the Middle East, another front, if you will. Unlike some of their neighbors, I think you'd agree that Syria has a formidable military resources and presence. And sometimes these conflicts can get out of hand. Any comments?
Well, you go back and look at our top trend for 2013 in the Trends Journal. It was war, and we've been writing about the lead-up to this for a long time. And in writing about that lead-up in previous Trends journals, we kept showing how the information coming out about what Syria was doing and who was involved has really been distorted to make the case for an attack rather than making its case for peace. And so I watched, for example, the recent Senate foreign intelligence hearings, and it was a disgrace listening to this charade that was going on. It reminded me of being in high school and listening to a principal and the students babble on. And then there was a report this past week in the Wall Street Journal analyzing what the so-called evidence is and really what it means, and it's two very different things. And the Wall Street Journal punched holes in just about all of it. So then when you see the report that came out from the Senate panel after the hearing, what they did was they changed the focus to, quote, change the momentum on the battlefield. So all of a sudden now, America is becoming involved in another foreign entanglement after losing Iraq, losing Afghanistan, causing a civil war in Libya, and now they're going to fix Syria? Of course there's going to be more destabilization. Oh, by the way, conveniently out of the news, hey, look what's going on over there in Egypt. Doesn't even make the newspapers anymore, and bloodshed continues, riots ensue, and destabilization is at levels that have never been seen before in recent history.
And, you know, we're seeing record oil prices, some sources suggesting that we might even revisit those 2008 levels that were staggering, you know, up to $147 a barrel for West Texas Intermediate crude. That has a tendency to, put downward pressure on economic output, as essentially everyone is paying more at the pumps to get to and from work and wherever else they need to travel, as well as our transportation systems. Any thoughts on how this developing situation in the Gulf there might affect it?
Well, that's part of it. The other part is, and you pointed out, I mean, we're looking at a Syria country of 20 million people. Let's suppose your family was wiped out and you lost everything that you had. You think you want to see revenge attacks? So now put this into perspective, Chris. Go back to this past April, and there was the Boston Marathon bombing. They closed down 100 square miles to hunt for a 19-year-old kid that was hiding in a boat. 100 square miles. Business stopped. A state of siege ensued. Now imagine, suppose there's a revenge attack at a 9/11 scale. Suppose there's a dirty bomb, for example, that would go off in San Francisco, or a suitcase-sized nuke, or biological warfare. This country goes on stop. And suppose the same thing happened in France or one of America's other allies. It'll destroy the economy. You have to understand. You don't have to understand. I say that, you know, just in putting it into perspective. I want to make this 100% clear. The United States military has not won a war since World War II. They lost Korea. They lost Vietnam. They lost Iraq. They lost Afghanistan. They destroyed Libya, civil war ensues, and now they're going to fix Syria? And the other level of hypocrisy, by the way, is all of this, oh my God, he used chemical weapons, and essentially, ostensibly 1,300 people have been killed. And we don't know who did what, by the way. I don't believe any of the information, unless you believe, remember the Maine, the Gulf of Tonkin incident that didn't happen, or the weapons of mass destruction, then you would take everything that they're saying at face value. Be that as it may, if you want to talk about hypocrisy and using weapons of mass destruction, hey, how about a couple of atom bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki? Oh, you like that Agent Orange that they sprinkled throughout Vietnam, or that napalm? What about all that white phosphorus and depleted uranium the United States has been using and has used in Iraq and Afghanistan and in other countries? Oh, Israel included, by the way, with the white phosphorus. And how about also what we're seeing going on if you kill somebody with carpet bombs or buster bunking bombs, what's the difference? Dead is dead. And to make all this thing about, oh, they use sarin gas, you know, how World War II that is, or World War I, and when you're using all these sophisticated weaponries. Hey, a drone is okay. You could kill with drones, but no unofficial FDA-approved chemical weapons. Oh, by the way, 1,400 dead in Egypt over the last 2 weeks. That's okay. They kill them with bullets. You can't kill them with gas.
You talk about our failure, you might say, to regulate our military efforts. And I'd like to go back to, you mentioned the last war that we really won, and that was World War II. And you might recall how we rebuilt the Axis powers, Italy, Germany, Japan. We helped rebuild, and as a result, the world looked at us and said, has there ever been a nation so benevolent that they actually defeat a power, and instead of horrible reparations that we saw during the Versailles Treaty, we actually rebuilt these nations. Now, fast forward to today, and unlike the little mini-conflict we actually won with Storm and Norman Schwarzkopf, the four-day war, that was maybe a model that we need to look back to. A four-day war, we went in, we got business taken care of, and then we pulled out instead of trying to micromanage the scenario. Any comments?
Well, yes. My comment is, I'm speaking now from Colonial Kingston, New York. As a matter of fact, tomorrow marks the 236th year that the New York State was actually formed right here in Kingston, the first capital of New York State, in 1777. It was on September 6, 1777. And I'm reminded, of course, about the Founding Fathers and General Washington among them, who in his farewell address warned about becoming involved in foreign entanglements. It's not our business. And as I'm here in Colonial Kingston, New York, and I see the difficulties that this city is having with its number of its population, I want to see my money going to restoring Kingston or Cleveland or Detroit or Camden. Not, $40 million a day, they're estimating, just in some aspects of a war against Syria. So this to me is way out of balance. And there is no such thing as going in and getting out, because if you look back to 1991, the rest of the 90s were involved in a war with Iraq. People forget the no-fly zones and bombs over Baghdad every time. It was a wag-the-dog moment every couple of months. So, no, I'm totally opposed to it as being an American and believing in the foundations of this country. And secondly, to see the lunacy, all anyone has to do, again, at that Senate hearing and listening to them babble on. Oh, and by the way, talking about babbling on, I am sick and tired. I don't want to hear it again. That if only women were in charge, there would be no war. I heard Barbara Boxer going on and on about the need for war. I heard this woman, the senator from New Hampshire, DeHaan, I believe her name is, or something like that. And then I saw that clip of Nancy Pelosi babbling on about a five-year-old grandson and what he had to say about the Syrian war. And I'll tell you why she was quoting the five-year-old grandson, because that's the mind of these people. They got the mind of five-year-olds. There's not a man or woman among them. Where are all the people saying no more to war? How much more money and men do we have to lose, and how many more people does America have to kill before they stop this madness? And here's my United General Salenti's four rules of peace. You're the commander-in-chief. You want to take out Assad? Great. Go take him out. Hey, they just found the bones of King Richard III recently. He got killed in the Battle of the Roses. I loved it, the War of the Roses. And they found him under a parking lot. That's how important he was. So when the king died, the war ended. And anybody out there that wants to support the war, send your kids, send yourself, send your money, send your wife. go do the fighting, keep me out of it. And number three, when they retaliate, don't go, oh, they hate our freedom and liberty, and they're terrorists. No, it's payback, the golden rule, do unto others you have them do unto you. So again, you know, this is all very clear. If everything is in place. If you want this war, you pay for it, you go fight it, and keep me out of it. It's going to be another losing battle. Nothing will be accomplished. And I listen to these people on the Senate hearing again. Well, we have every contingency in place to make sure that if the first contingency doesn't work, the second one will.
I'd like to touch on a couple of key anecdotes here. Firstly, you talk about this idea that war is good. You know, it reminds one of George Orwell's 1984, you know, war is peace and endless war. But that takes me back to the 1990s with General Schwarzkopf. If you've had a chance to read his book, it's really quite illuminating. He was one of these amazing folks who actually fought in Vietnam, and he was the type of commander who would run back through open machine gun fire to pick up one of his wounded comrades. And this actually happened. He ran through a minefield one time, not knowing whether he would lose a leg or a limb, and carried a wounded soldier back to the helicopter. He earned several medals just for that one event. And the reason I mention this is that when he talked about his tenure there at taking our troops in on the four-day, 100-hour mini-battle or war in the early 90s, he talks about how he hates war, and he knows the horror of it, and not get entangled in one of these 10-year or longer Vietnam-like scenarios where you could arguably say we're in currently in the Middle East, a quagmire.
And it wasn't like I was intelligent enough to know that they lied us into it. There was no Gulf of Tonkin incident as they reported it. It was a total lie. I was just a young kid, you know, 18 years old, and I couldn't imagine me in a foreign country with a lot of weight on my back getting shot at. There are some guys like Schwarzkopf that liked that trip. And what did he do? We killed 3 million people over there? For what? For a lie? And now we're doing business with the Vietnamese? And I see Hillary Clinton over there when she was Secretary of State saying how we're going to defend the Vietnamese against the Chinese in their dispute over these islands? The whole war thing is a big lie. What? Look, listen to General Dwight D. Eisenhower, leaving office, five-star general, supreme commander of the Allied forces, and he warns the American people that the military-industrial complex is taking over, robbing us of the future of the genius of the scientists, the sweat of our labors, and the future of our nation. And look at the future of our nation throughout the Cold War and all these wars. Look at how this country is going downhill so quickly. Look at the gap between the rich and the poor. Look at the wages that people are not making. Look at how 97% of the jobs that are being created are part-time jobs, Chris. This whole war thing is draining the morality, lifeblood, and life out of this country. That was Schwarzkopf's trip. I'm totally against. Look, I'm not a pacifist. I'm a second-degree close combat practitioner. If anybody tries to do anything to me, I will do everything I have to do to stop them, and if I need to kill them, if they're trying to kill me, I will. I'm not a pacifist. I mind my own business. I love this language. Militants attack U.S. base in Afghanistan. Militants attack U.S. base. What if this was reversed? Would it be militants, Afghan militants attack, American militants attack
Afghan base in Alabama, in Birmingham, Alabama?
This is sickness to me. This is total sickness. It's a delusion. And I'm telling you, all you have to do is watch the players. This guy Corker, what a corker he is, shooting his little mouth off. I went through the list of all these guys at that Senate hearing. A bunch of chicken hawks and draft dodgers. Every one of these loudmouths, this Representative Engel we have over here in New York. And all they want to do is go fight. Go fight. Go lead the charge. I don't want you taking my money. And that's the way I look at it. I want every cent of my money staying in the United States. And these people are now taking us to another losing disaster. And worse than that, as I wrote in the Trends Journal, continue to write and have been writing over the years, they're leading us into World War III. And you know that saying by Einstein, I don't know how the Third World War will be fought, but I know the fourth will be fought with sticks and stones.
Exactly, because we don't know just how things might get out of hand. You know, I was reading an interesting article the other day about World War II and the events that led up to the horrific nightmare of that terrible global war. All sides were convinced it would be just a quick little war, and before you know it, things will be settled and everything, peace will be. It was just their officials that threw them into the conflict. We never know just how things might unfold. You know, you have Russia and China that are adamantly opposed to any conflict with Syria. Of course, I'm sure you've read that Russia has armed Syria with many of their protective missiles, some of which have incredibly long range. Why do we want to antagonize the entire world? And, you know, that leads me back to your comments about George Washington. You know, he was one of the most failed commanders in world history. He lost virtually every conflict he ever went into in the French-American Indian War. Look at the American Revolution. We almost lost that as well. But so to hear someone like that say, we don't need to get entangled with these conflicts around the world.
And it's not only him. It's you go through all the founding fathers. They were all opposed to it. And here we are in the midst of it. Now, I ask you this question. You name me one, just one great success that has come out of Washington when they've started, whether it's a war on drugs, a war in the Middle East, to fix education with their education czars. Name me one successful program that you could look at to Washington and say, wow, these are a bunch of intelligent people. I feel very confident that they know what they're doing. Tell me one.
It's hard. It's hard to do.
Maybe no, tell me one.
Meals on Wheels, maybe? I love that program.
It's not, you know, it's more local.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a little thing.
No,
losers.
Yeah.
They're losers.
No,
they can't
balance
the budget. Why would any self-respecting adult listen to what these people have to say? That's the way I look at it. And you know the motto taught to me by my dear father, may his soul rest in peace, think for yourself. And that's what I'm saying. I'm not saying you should think like this. As I see it, these guys and women are a bunch of losers. Leaders, they couldn't lead me across the street. And again, if they want to lead the charge. Our forecast is this. If the United States goes to war with Syria, as I wrote in the Trends Journal that went out as the top trends for 2013, it's the beginning of the first great war of the 21st century.
Well, you know, there are some folks who are claiming that we're already in the early stages of World War III. You just don't declare war many times until long after the stage has been set and the chess pieces are already in motion.
Well, that's exactly it. That's what we've been writing about. And again, you know, I've been writing about this for a number of years. You know, what are people waiting for, an Archduke Ferdinand moment? You know, oh, that, well, now it's official. You know, I mean, this thing is going on. Look, let's make this clear. There's a war in Syria, there's a war in Libya. There's a war in Yemen, there's a war in Bahrain, there's a war in Congo, there's a war in the Sudan. They're warring throughout many nations in Africa. There's civil wars going on, but they don't call them that. And those civil wars are what's going on in Greece and in Spain and in Portugal with this rampant unemployment levels, youth unemployment levels, likes of which have never been seen before. You have a civil war going on in Egypt. Oh, by the way, the United States government has still refused to call it a military coup over there in Egypt. I mean, it's just your imagination that guy Sisi is in charge over there, always wears that military uniform and those dark glasses that's right out of a comic book. That's only your imagination that the military overthrew it. Our government says it wasn't a military coup. So as you go around the world, you can see this destabilization. And then you start adding in more economics into it, because that's really a lot of what goes on behind the scenes. And as you well know, being with Goldseek, you see what's going on in the emerging markets and how they've lost 11%, you know, they're down 11% this year already. And you see a currency crisis emerging with the Brazilian real, with the Indian rupee, with the Turkish lira, and on and on. you can see these currencies that are going through all these problems as all this hot money is drying up with the fear that interest rates are going up. So you're going to see more and more destabilization. And you know my saying, when all else fails, they take you to war. And that's what they're doing now.
I mean, it's a favorite tactic for supposedly pulling economies out of the quagmire because, well, folks start working and spills over into the economy. But in the final analysis, I stick with your earlier comments, and that is we don't need any part of it. The blowback from this one day will be simply more than this nation can manage. And as we wrap up here, any parting comments, any topics that you'd like to share as we close?
Well, I think it's very important what we're seeing now also with gold, you know, losing a lot of its strength recently that has gained, or some of its strength, and the fear, of course, with the pullback on tapering and stopping some of the hot money flowing in. I believe that they're not going to be able to taper too much, particularly now that they're saying in the emerging markets that the only way to save their failing currencies is to raise interest rates so that their currencies aren't depreciated even more. Well, how do you raise interest rates in a declining economy without destroying the economy? So I think any kind of tapering, any type of pullbacks is only going to be temporary because they're going to have to juice the economies with more hot money. And when that hot money flows in, gold goes higher.
No, exactly. You know, I think the markets have either factored it in or priced in most of the taper talk by now. And I think they're starting to look for future economic growth. And, you know, we're also seeing surprising growth out of China. Unexpectedly strong economic numbers. The Eurozone looks like it might be finally turning the corner there in its recession. If you bring that all together, that economic improvement certainly could bode well for the precious metals after having such a difficult 2013 so far.
Well, actually, I see more instability, which is going to be stronger for gold. And I don't see, I see the recovery. Yeah, and I see the recovery in Europe being temporary. And I know also that there's a huge debt bubble floating in China that's going to have to be addressed. And the government, despite their calls recently not to keep pumping in money, are doing so. And that's going to reverse as well. So I see more instability coming in the coming months. But I do see that they're going to try to do everything, both in the United States and in Europe, as we already saw at the ECB, keeping interest rates near their record lows, to keep the economy propped up to Christmas time, at least. And so that means more hot money flowing in because they're not going to risk bringing down retail sales at a time when retail sales are already soft.
Very good. Well, low interest rates and safe haven buying, certainly music to the ears of our listeners today. Any contact information you'd like to share with the listeners?
Well, you saw the New Trends Journal. It's history before it happens. It's all revamped, a whole new look. And I recommend that everyone consider it's money-back guarantee, nothing to lose, trendsjournal.com, trendsjournal.com. And I can guarantee you, Chris, it's the only magazine where you can read history before it happens.
Now, you've assembled a fantastic team and hat tip for such an economic think tank. You know, and that's what we really need. We need, I don't know, like a university of like-minded individuals who are thinking outside of the box and not afraid to push the limits, because that's the only way we get to the truth. Gerald Celente, thanks so much.
Hey, thank you, Chris.
Hello, Chris. Thanks for the excellent radio show. I had a quick question about the deal between Iran and China. And specifically, everything I've heard you say on the radio is that once gold goes into China, it's illegal for it to come out. Is that illegal for citizens? Because if there's a deal where China is buying Iran's oil for gold, then is it that the only gold coming out of China is through the government to make big purchases? Or why aren't they using their reserves of dollars and selling it that way? So thanks for clearing up that. Hope you have a great one. Please keep on doing a great show. Have a great one. Bye.
And the first caller would like to know why China is importing so much gold and if it's circumventing the dollar payment blockade with Iran by using gold as a substitute currency. Well, caller, what a fantastic point you've made here. You're way ahead of most of the analysts that I read. In 2011, President Obama imposed trade sanctions on Iran to halt their nuclear enrichment program. Now, these sanctions punish any foreign financial institution which conducts transactions with Iran for its crude oil, cutting off Iran from the U.S. financial system. Now, China is Iran's largest trading partner, but the nation is also heavily dependent, of course, on trade with the U.S. So officials in Tehran agreed to accept gold as payment for oil. So there you have it, a likely component in the recent gold sell-off. However, I would note that this really only postpones the reckoning day. Eventually, I expect the gold paid to Iran to find its way back to China and India, who will promptly use the dollars to make gold purchases, thus reversing the lopsided process and eventually leading to runaway global inflation and very high precious metals prices.
Hi, my name is Moses, and I'm calling about what to do if I have 20 or 30K that I want to invest, take it out of sitting in my bank doing nothing. But I'll need it for in about 4 to 6 months. I need to withdraw it. And should I be buying gold stocks or some of your stock picks? I have some longer-term metals that I'm holding on to for 4 years now. But I wanted to do something to take advantage of this dip in the market.
All right, next up, Moses says he has around $30,000, if I understood his statement there correctly, in his savings account. He'll need to use the funds in about 4 to 6 months, and he has a long-term position in the precious metals. He'd like to know if I recommend any gold stock picks or any of my Alpha Stocks newsletter picks. First off, congratulations on accumulating a solid core portfolio. You are way ahead of most Americans, most of whom do not have even $1,000 in savings. Now, it sounds like you could use some diversification and higher yield growth exposure. A savings account will not provide either of these important components. Since you have a solid precious metals portfolio already, I would suggest diversifying into high-yielding bonds and high-yielding dividend-paying stocks. Then, depending on your risk tolerances and stage in life, you might direct 5 or 10% of your funds into a risky stock with explosive potential. For instance, each week I provide a moonshot stock candidate. These are stocks with very low float, usually undervalued by at least 95 to 99% or more, given the current discounted cash flow method, and with technical conditions that suggest a 1 to even 100-fold increase. Now, by limiting your exposure to such risky plays, you minimize risk while maximizing the potential return. If a stock climbs, let's say, 500% and you've only used about 10% or so of your funds, your portfolio increases by over 50%. But if the stock tumbles, you can never lose more than 10% of your portfolio. This 1 to 5 or so, 1 to 3, 1 to 5 risk-to-reward ratio is ideal. Plus, I include 5 mega dividend stocks each week with a typical dividend yield of 10 to 12% with at least 100% growth potential. However, I cannot recommend my service to you at this time, unfortunately, because these stock candidates are long-term oriented. Your 4 to 6 month time horizon will not meet that requirement. But if you decide to become a longer-term investor with your equities and bonds, I suggest, you know, by all means, sign up for the newsletter.
Hey, Chris, how are you doing? This is Marcus from Brooklyn. I had a quick question here about gold lease rates. I was looking at the chart, and it appears that the 30-day gold lease rate, as well as the 60-day and the 6-month lease rate, appeared to have gone negative on April around the 18th or the 19th. And essentially, it appears that for a brief period of a couple days, the percentage was actually negative, which would, I suppose, mean that someone was paying people to hold gold. I'm not quite sure. But any insight on that would be interesting. Hope you're well. Thanks so much for everything you do. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Marcus from Brooklyn asks about the negative gold lease rate. And this is simply the rate that you would receive if you were to lease your gold. Usually it's institutions and governments that are leasing their gold. So you wouldn't expect the rate to be zero, unless there was a surplus of gold in circulation. However, I'd note that, you know, the 1 to 3 month lease rates are well above the troughs that were carved out in 2011 and 2012, and do not seem to be a particular concern here. You might want to view the amazing lease rate spike during the credit crisis. It's really quite a sight to behold. All right, that quickly powers through all the questions and comments, closing down the phone line. And remember, folks, we'd like to field your questions and comments. I couldn't get to the email. No time for email. The calls take priority. You can call in anytime you like, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's toll-free within the United States and probably parts of Canada as well. The number, 1-800-507-6531. 800-507-6531. If you'd like, you can jot it down on a post-it pad and keep that close to your phone. Or you might just plug 800-507-6531 right into your cell phone or home phone for quick and easy access. And once again, you can reach us 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You can cancel at any time you like. You don't have to speak to anyone. You can delete and start over again as many times as you like. Well, my featured guest today has over 30 years of experience in the precious metals field. Mr. Jay Taylor, editor of Jay Taylor's Gold Energy Tech Stocks newsletter, host of the web-based radio show Turning Hard Times into Good Times. Welcome back, Mr. Taylor.
Good to be with you.
You know, I understand that you are interested in a couple of stocks that are also favorites of GoldSeek.com analysts, including Golden Arrow Resources and Timmins Gold. So I thought we might begin today with Golden Arrow. That's ticker GRG.TO at StockCharts.com. Golden Arrow Resources is a Vancouver-based exploration company. They focus primarily on Argentina, and I understand the flagship property is the Chinchillas property, located in the prolific Bolivian silver-zinc-tin belt. I understand that some interesting results they've had there recently, and I thought you might tell us more about the Chinchillas silver property.
Yeah, it really looks to me like they're onto something potentially very large there, and they've had some really good numbers, some really impressive intersections of silver with some base metals as well, some lead and some zinc. You know, like, for example, they recently, with 108 meters of 125 grams per ton silver, 1.2% lead, 20 meters of 379 grams silver, and 2.1% lead. Some other big numbers, like 93 meters of 182 grams silver with some lead and zinc. And, of course, it's still early days, but that was phase two of the drilling. I think we could be looking at potentially a couple hundred million ounces of silver, but what's really exciting and really opens up the possibilities of something big is the fact that they've hit into a feeder zone that could really, I think, really increase the numbers very dramatically, the numbers and the grades. So it's, you know, it's still, as I say, early days, but the share price is down, knocked down so low. It's such a small market cap with something very potentially very big happening. And, of course, this is a company that has it's really operating in large part as a project generator company. So it's not spending its own money on most of the projects. It has a huge portfolio of projects in Argentina in highly prospective areas of the country. And it has, you know, it has other companies spending their money to try to earn into them. They do have a major copper discovery that is being explored by a major company. And also, here's one of the things that I think really attracted my attention here was the recent addition of Carlos Maze to the company. Carlos, I think, really is a real class act, has a great history. He's an engineer, a mining engineer, but he was involved in the financing and development of the San Cristobal project in Bolivia. That's a huge silver mine, a $1 billion investment, and he really had a lot of success with that and putting that into production, getting it up and running, a 40-ton per day operation. And he's also been involved in the Clinton-Joustra Sustainable Growth Initiative. And so I think he brings connections, the technical background that is very impressive. For a company that has such a minuscule market cap, I think this is one that could be absolutely huge. So that's the reason I personally own it. I've recommended it to my subscribers, and they have also been a sponsor on my own radio show. As a matter of full disclosure, I do have a vested interest in seeing this company succeed, but I think it will, and that's why I got involved with it. I think, you know, the management, Joe Grasso has been there since the inception of the company, went out and staked some fantastic properties. And now, of course, it's not the easiest time to raise capital, but the company, I think, is wisely developing this Chinchillas property because I think it has the potential to become a world-class silver deposit.
You know, another couple of interesting aspects. I understand the property is closely located to Barrick Gold's highly successful gold and silver mine, as well as Silver Standard's prolific silver mine.
That's right. And it's in the right address in the Bolivian tin silver belt, for sure. Well, we know now that there's something big going on here because of these kind of intersections. Numerous ones. We don't have a resource. I think they're going to be calculating a resource fairly soon, and that, I think, might start to gain some investor attention. But I think we're going to see something very noteworthy taking place here. Yeah, I mean, I just think right now people don't like these kinds of companies, exploration companies, but this is one I think has a great chance for success.
Another property here, the Pescado property, is apparently adjacent to Yamana Gold's mine. Are you familiar with this property?
Well, yeah, to a lesser extent. I just know that they have properties everywhere that are, you know, highly prospective areas. And of course, the issue is to what extent can they get other companies to come in and fund them? Because one of the biggest risks that these little companies face, especially in markets like this, is getting other companies, you know, is dilution. But, you know, we're looking at a share structure here with, I think we're looking at 41 or 42 million shares outstanding only, you know, with such a low share price. If they get some traction in the Chinchillas or the copper deposit comes in big, which is being explored by a major company, then I think this company share price could really take off. Well, I just don't see a lot of downside risk from these current levels. I mean, that's maybe a dangerous thing to say, but given what this at the Chinchillas and given all this company has going for it, I think this is a very enviable entry point.
Very good. Well, let's move on now to the Timmins Gold Company. Apparently, they own and operate the San Francisco Gold Mine. That's their flagship operation in Sonora, Mexico. I understand that they have also had some interesting news. Gold reserves of 1.33 million ounces, reported record production of about 28,000 gold ounces for the first quarter of the year. Any comments here on Timmins?
Oh, yeah. Timmins has been a longtime favorite. I picked up my newsletter years ago when it was selling for pennies, so we've had a lot of success with Timmins. But I tell you that what this company is really executing, you know what, I'm very, very selective on when it comes to exploration companies these days, and the one we just talked about, Golden Arrow, is one I love a lot for reasons that I just really discussed. But for the most part, in this market situation, I want to own companies that are producing cash flows that can grow organically. And growth is, you know, it's what we're talking about with Timmins and good, solid cash flows. They earned 25 cents a share this last year, 2012, versus 15 cents, 2011. The stock price is down very considerably. It's down to $2.50, 144 million shares outstanding. So it gives the market cap around 365 million, but it had operating profits last year of $60 million. As I say, earned 25 cents a share. Those numbers should improve this year because the company is projecting production this year of 125 to 130,000 ounces of gold compared to 94,000 last year at similar cost, cash costs of around $700 to $750. But again, I think they have the potential to grow. It's a low-grade, open-pit, heap-leach situation, but it's my understanding they have the potential to really increase very substantially, of course, as you mentioned, with 1.3 million ounces of gold, that gives the company at these levels, you know, a good 10 years of operating potential there. But they have lots of exploration potential. So internal growth, you know, they just recently increased their crushing facility, which is really allowing them to increase their production right now. But I think the longer term, this company has a chance to grow continually, to continue to grow its production and earnings. So to be able to have cash at a time when there's a lot of companies can't make ends meet, exploration companies that have spent millions of dollars putting down drill holes, gathering data, you know, partially proving up projects, companies that have the cash flow to grow either organically with the projects they already have or to go out and scrape up some companies that can't move their projects forward, I think puts Timmins in a very enviable position, especially with its share price down recently from around $3 when I first started looking at it again to around $2.50. I think it's a very good situation.
Timmins also has caught the attention of institutional investors, which own apparently 60% of the shares outstanding, big names like Oppenheimer. But I also wanted to give you a chance to touch on the infrastructure. That's, of course, an important component of success. Timmins has access, apparently, to the Pan American Highway. It has water rights, power grid connections, and a skilled local labor force. Also, solid community relations. The nation is considered a mining-friendly area. Any other comments on Timmins?
Well, I think you stated it well. Of course, that's infrastructure is always very, very important. No, I think that pretty well summarizes it. I just think, you know, cash flow, growth, internal, organically, they don't have to go out and issue more shares, very important issue in this day and age, especially in this market. So these are the kind of opportunities where you can, you know, pick up companies that are really cheap, that have the goods, that are growing, and Timmins is certainly among my favorites in that regard.
Very good. Well, Mr. Jay Taylor, we want to thank you for your comments on both companies today. Is there anything else you'd like to share with the listeners as we wrap up?
Yeah, only that I think that we're nearing a bottom in this. I don't know that we're at the bottom yet in this decline in the gold and silver price.
Robert Kiyosaki has sold over 30 million books worldwide, but did you know he's also a prepper? That's right. He's stockpiling precious metals and survival goods, and he was doing so long before it became the trendy thing to do. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the show the best-selling author of Rich Dad, Poor Dad book series, Robert Kiyosaki. Welcome back, sir.
Oh, thank you, Chris. I like your program.
You know, you say that the middle class is disappearing around Europe, and you note that if the U.S. dollar continues its decline, the world could actually collapse. Could you tell us more, please?
I'm a baby boomer, and I remember in the 60s when President Johnson said he's going to save the poor. They obviously didn't do a good job on that. In this last election, you have both Romney and Obama wanting to save the middle class. Tragic, but I think it's kind of funny. Anytime the presidential candidates want to save you, it's really tragic is that the middle class is now sliding into poverty. So today I was reading this article that in America, the problem isn't unemployment. The problem is underemployment. And in America alone, there's 146 million working people with jobs, working Americans, who are not earning enough to survive. In other words, if they need $10 per day, they're making $9. And 147 million of them, and soon some of them will start retiring, and then they'll start collecting more money. So we're sitting on a crisis that's huge.
It's a startling statistic. We've been using that 147 figure on the show for about a year now, and you are right. The number breaks down that the underemployed, or what some folks are referring to as the near poverty line, is roughly half of the country right now. That seems like a scenario for serious social unrest. Any thoughts?
You're speaking to the choir here. I don't know how people survive. And the person called these people the invisible people. Like, you know, you walk in down a hotel room and they're the guys cleaning your rooms or doing stuff around the place. You just don't see them. They're hardworking people. And it really breaks my heart that they work for nothing or that they even do work. You know, I mean, I know people who would rather not work and just collect welfare or entitlement. It's now called entitlements. You're entitled to it. So many of these people, if they weren't so honorable, they would just be the 47% who gets paid to do nothing.
Apparently, there are a huge number of millionaires collecting welfare payments at this time, workers' compensation and related payments. So, I mean, you know, maybe there are disincentives for almost every section of our society right now. You also point out that you're concerned that rioting could become intense in the U.S. once the economy starts to unravel. Won't authorities keep handing out new social incentives like our food stamps? You know, 48 million people currently on food stamps, and you say there's only 3 days of groceries on the shelves. How much time do you think for the music stops here?
I just believe, like a Boy Scout, to be prepared. I was in Dallas Airport the other day, and a bunch of women came by, and they're all healthy women. I mean, they were, you know, in their 40s and all this, obviously able-bodied, and they were really proudly wearing T-shirts that say, "I'm the 47% that doesn't work and doesn't pay taxes." I'm going, holy mackerel. You know, I mean, what has happened to us? What happened to the American dream? The people came over from both Europe and Asia to come here and build something for yourself. And now people think they're entitled to things. It's tragic.
You know, I think a big part of this is when you start to tax folks into oblivion, you reduce those incentives that, you know, their ancestors had. I mean, once you lose that entrepreneurial spirit, it removes the drive that you have to create new ideas, new products, new services, and you start to fall into a malaise.
Tout my latest, my greatest new book is called Why A Students Work for C Students and B Students Work for the Government. And the premise of that book, which was just released, is that we don't have a financial crisis. We have an educational crisis. And the question I have for people is where are people taught the idea that you're entitled to something? It's in school. And they don't teach, you know, as a young boy, I'm in my 60s now, but as a boy of 9 and 10, I said, you know, why don't you teach me about money? And, money's evil. And these are people like my poor dad, good people who are school teachers who know nothing about money. And these same people, again, they're good people, most of them, are teaching your kids 8 hours a day in school. And we still don't teach kids anything about money. I had this one teacher say to me, well, we're teaching kids to balance a checkbook. And I said, ma'am, checkbooks aren't the problem. Credit card debt and student loan debt is the problem. Oh, no, you don't know what you're talking about. I'm going, they're so out of touch. They're good people, but they're basically socialists.
I've heard it said that a person who lives just beyond their means, misery, those who live just under their means, contentment and happiness. And I think it would do us all a lot of good to have incorporated that into our, I guess, our educational system early on. You drink the Kool-Aid of debt. It's out there in so many forms now, from credit cards, student loans, car payments, mortgages. They have lots of fancy names for it, and they're awfully glad to hand you the documents. But in the final analysis, it does tend to get the everyday folks in trouble, not referring to financiers like yourself who have the knowledge and understanding of how to wisely use debt and equity. I'm referring to the everyday folks who get themselves caught into the debt trap. You know, you're also on record that at some point the crowd is going to rush to the safe harbor of gold and silver. Estimates show that very few, if any, Americans have any gold or silver, precious metals of any substance, maybe less than 1 or 2%. So what's it going to take to turn people back to these barbarous relics?
Well, that's a good question also. As you know, the gold come off from approximately 1900 to around 1400 an ounce. And when my friends asked me why that happens, I said, well, it's been a 10-year run, and so it had to have a pullback. But also there was something else that happened in between the start, which is the year 2000, where it was at approximately $300 an ounce, to when it hit $1,900 an ounce. What happened was the amateurs got into the market, and the amateurs came in through these things called ETFs. And excuse me, I don't buy these things. I don't know. I think they're GLD and SLV. I buy the hard asset, or I buy the mining companies. So what happened is these amateurs came into the market, and when it was around 1900, they started piling in. And then, as you know, when amateurs come in, the pros pulled the rug on them, and the thing went down. So I think that scared off the amateurs. You know, they're now saying, well, it is a barbarous metal and all this, which is kind of good, because I see it at gold at $1,300 an ounce, another time to start buying for me. So my whole recommendation for people is always this. You don't just buy because something's going up. You know, Warren Buffett said the stupidest reason to buy something is because the price is going up. You must understand the underlying fundamentals of why the price is going up. So to understand what's going on in the world today, I look at Japan, which has now gone to QE infinity, and they're going to print. Europe is slowing down, so they're going to have to print. China is slowing down. They have to print. So it's going to make America look good for a while, because people will be rushing from Asia and Europe into America, which gives us this false sense of a good economy. But eventually that sleigh ride has to end also. They just can't keep pumping fiat money into the United States, because that money is now looking for a home, which is going to cause inflation. So that's why, you know, I love gold. I've always loved gold. You know, as my friend Ron Paul said, He says, you know, 200 years ago, Spanish galleons went down, and 200 years later, people still die for gold. But 200 years from now, nobody's going to die for the dollar.
Exactly right. Now, I think you hit the nail on the head. You know, the paper market for the precious metals cratered, and we saw that break below support. We saw something similar in 2008, 2009. Premiums explode. For instance, right now at the APMEX, last time I checked, you could buy a 100-ounce silver bar for not much less than $29, $30 an ounce, even though the paper price is around $22, $23 an ounce. So we see this disconnect, if you will, between the paper and the premium. That usually sets the stage for opportunity. But I wanted to also move on to the deflation, hyperinflation argument. You seem to think that we're going to have one or the other, and every time the precious metals swoon, the deflationists claim victory. But, you know, I still see the trend sharply higher in gold in the long, long term.
Well, in the short term, it's collapse, as you know. And collapse is as bad as it gets, and I'm really glad Bernanke, I mean, as much as I disagree with his policy, I'm glad he printed money to prevent a collapse, because if it had collapsed, we'd be dead for a long time. We might have cleaned it up faster, but this printing money keeps us alive longer. Look, you've got to take a bigger view of it. When you look at the last depression, let's say around 1930, the reason America came out of it, people say because of World War II, that's not really true. Why we came out of it, the Bretton Agreement was signed and the U.S. dollar became the reserve currency of the world. But the other thing that happened that is different than this depression is in 1945, when the so-called depression so-called ended, is that we had factories back after World War II. And today, America doesn't have any factories. So during this depression, there's no jobs. There's only low-paying service jobs. So when I look at the first depression, 1930, and today's depression at 2013, I say, what's missing? What's missing are factories and high-paying jobs. So I think the deflation is going to run longer versus inflation. Now, there's going to be inflation in gold and oil and food. Of course, the government doesn't count that as inflation. So anyway, if you're going to play this market or be in the gold market, you have to understand what's different from this depression from the depression of our parents. The depression of our parents, there were jobs. This depression, no jobs. That's going to cause havoc on the whole financial system throughout the world.
Jobs are such an important component here. You know, we're still roughly 7.9% on the national unemployment rate. The Fed has targeted, as you know, 6.5%, the level where they claim they'll pull back on the QE and maybe adjust interest rates. So we're still a good distance away from there. Also, let's take a look at Japan. They're ramping up stimulus like never before. There is talk of a currency war there. And that, of course, has sent the Nikkei to record levels, which is their stated goal. So when you bring all this stimulus together, add in Europe, add in China as well, you know, you've got a situation where I would certainly want to have something that was going to protect my purchasing power.
I hope you already explained this, but what happens is when Japan devalues the yen, that makes the dollar expensive. So if the dollar is expensive, then we export less. So that means if the U.S. is going to compete with Japan, it also must devalue the dollar, which makes our exports more affordable, but it makes life more expensive inside the U.S. So that's why I found it really surprising the last few weeks that the price of gold came down. At the same time, Abe, the Japanese prime minister, said he was going to print. In my mind, which shows you how much I know, the price of gold should have gone up when Abe, which is Japan, announces a huge stimulus called printing money, devaluing the purchasing power of the yen, which will ultimately devalue the purchasing power of the dollar, which will make gold more expensive. But as I said, one of the reasons, many reasons for the crash in the price of gold, one of them is the amateurs got out of gold ETFs and silver ETFs. Plus, you had Cyprus. Who knows what went on there? So I just look at this whole thing as, well, okay, when it gets down to around 1,300 for gold, I'm going to come back in with my pickup truck.
Well, you know, actually, you are correct. The price of gold in terms of yen exploded on that announcement from Prime Minister Abe. Gold actually hit an all-time record high on their monetary stimulus. I also wanted to touch a bit on this talk of ATM shutting down during the Hurricane Katrina disaster in the Gulf, and more recently with the Hurricane Sandy event on the East Coast. Is America facing a Cyprus-like event where people wake up to empty ATMs and take massive haircuts on their savings accounts?
Well, there already are a Cyprus. I mean, that's what I'm saying. You don't just buy gold to buy gold. You have to understand the whole monetary system. And that goes back to 1944 when the Bretton Woods Agreement was signed and the U.S. dollar became the reserve currency. In other words, instead of saving gold, they saved dollars. Then in 1971, a few years later, Nixon took us off the gold standard, which meant the United States could just rob the world. So they robbed your savings. That's why I've always said at Rich Dad, savers are losers, is because you put, let's say, $100 in the bank, and the bank prints $100, well, your savings just went down by 50%. So they're doing the Cyprus event just by stimulus or quantitative easing, printing money. The reason Cyprus couldn't do that is because they don't have the printing press. So they had to then steal directly via taxes from the shareholders, which they never really did because the money came out through England anyway for the rich Russians. But the point here is the average person with no financial education, you're getting, which is the reason, you know, people like you and I recommend gold and silver, is because they really can't just manipulate it. And well, they do manipulate it, but not as much as paper money.
Exactly. They can't print it, I guess, is what your point is. There's actually some talk that J.P. Morgan was bailed out via the powers that be by crashing the precious metals because of their allegedly huge naked short position on silver. Of course, you also alluded to the inflation situation where people have called it the cruelest of taxes. You really have no vote on inflation, where you can vote down, you know, or kick out the folks who raise your taxes. This is an invisible tax, if you will, and unfortunately, it's difficult to gauge. It's difficult to understand for those who have, as you say, limited access to information and education on the subject. So that's going to be, I think, a huge factor going forward. Also wanted to talk to you about gold confiscation. Can you envision a time when governments make ownership so costly through taxes and regulations that people are tricked into giving up their metal, their safety net, their precious metals? For instance, you may have read that in Houston, Texas, all gold sales now require the seller to submit to fingerprinting. Should folks own precious metals offshore to protect against something like this?
Singapore has a great offshore program. I went to check it out. It's really, really good. You know, your private jet pulls up, and it pulls up right next to the modern facility, and your gold goes right into storage, and the jet continues on. I mean, I was there to watch it. So the thing I'm saying, I don't do that. I'm not recommending that. I'm just saying that that's what the rich really do. I always recommend, you know, because I wasn't not, you know, I'm not mega rich, but the biggest asset you have is your education, which is why for years with Rich Dad Poor Dad, I said, why don't we have financial education in school? Well, because that way you can do whatever you like to them. And so if you're still saving money and have your money in mutual funds, that's the most manipulated. At least gold and silver, it's harder to manipulate. So I'd rather have gold and silver than cash or mutual funds.
Fortuitous that you'd mentioned Singapore. One of the other guests on the show this week will be Jim Rogers, who, of course, has a home in Singapore, and he is a big fan of the yellow metal, and like yourself, he's actually looking forward to this drop, has been excited by the fact that it's pulled back, and is interested in loading the boat or backing up the pickup truck as well on gold. But, you know, this deluge has had an immediate impact on demand. You've probably read that there's a gold rush right now in India and China, particularly in India because of the upcoming wedding season and important festivals there. They tend to have dowry-related purchases. Demand is expected to be at record once again all the way through June and July. Are you factoring any of this into your analysis?
Yeah, I've been a gold bug since 72, and I've always heard those things and all that stuff, and I like rumors just as much as anybody else. But the reason I buy gold and silver comes down to one thing, is I don't trust my government. So what's my way of saying, if you trust your government to do a good job running the economy, then buy stocks, bonds, and mutual funds. If you don't trust your government, buy gold and silver. That's as simple as I can get with it, because it comes down to management of the economy. And when I see what our government, I'm not Republican or Democrat, is how they're managing this economy, then you look a few years into the future, the biggest liabilities of all, Social Security and Medicare, and you got to ask yourself, is it going to solve the Medicare and Social Security problem? No. I don't think anybody can. Could Hillary do it? Could Marco Rubio do it? No. So that's why I don't trust my government or my leaders. I rather trust gold and silver. And that's as simple as my thoughts are. I mean, I don't want to get into conspiracies and all that stuff. I just rather have gold and silver.
Many Americans agree with you. Sales of American Gold Eagles exceeded the entire sales figure last month. In only 2 days of this month, the U.S. Mint had a record sales of 153,000 ounces already, and there was still about a week left in the month so far, that there just won't be enough to go around. I mean, will people be prepared when the big collapse finally arrives?
I really don't know any of that. I can plug my book as why A students work for C students and B students work for the government. It talks about how my rich dad, starting at age 9, taught me how to print my own money. Well, I just copy the Fed. I also copy the tax laws of the rich. And so once I understood this, all financial education, once I understood that, it's kind of the reverse gold process where the Fed is printing money. What I do is I print money also, but I buy gold with my money. But I have been trained to print my own money. And you can too. And that's what I cover in my book. Also, what's hard for people to understand, which took a long time writing why A students work for C students, is debt and taxes make the poor and middle class poor. Debt and taxes make the rich rich. So if you can understand that every coin has at least three sides, head, tails, and the edge of the coin, the purpose of why A students work for C students was to have you see both sides of the coin from the edge, so you can make up your own mind which way you want to go. So since it's relatively easy for me to make money, then I just buy gold. If you don't have, if you're having trouble making money, then you have other problems. You see, that's the whole reason I say we don't have a financial crisis. We have an educational crisis. I mean, how many people graduated from school with good grades who are still broke? Why is that? Why is it that Romney made $21 million in the campaign around 2011, he paid 13% in taxes, and Obama made $3 million and paid 23% in taxes. And what I cover in why A students work for C students is how Romney pays 13% and how Obama pays 23%. That's financial education. I'm not saying it's right or wrong, because I like to get my interest, I like to get my tax rate down to zero. But I've been trained to do that. Most people have not. And I do it legally, by the way. So the whole point here is this. Without financial education, a lot of times you're just guessing at all this stuff, trying to figure out which way Obama, whoever's next, or Bush, whoever's elected next, goes. I personally don't trust any of them. I rather trust myself. And that's really kind of why I study, and I like being an American. I just don't trust my government.
Sounds like another must-read book. Any parting comments, sir, for the listeners today?
I'll say it again, you know, it's opposite. Debt and taxes make person poor, and debt and taxes make the rich rich. And if you want to find out why, that's where financial education comes from. Like, I make millions of dollars and pay 0% in tax legally. And that's why I just buy gold, because I really don't need cash, because I learned to print my own money. And really, that's what I, and the book is written for parents with kids. So if you're worried about your kids' education, you should be, because schools will never teach them about money. And that's why I wrote why A students work for C students, is for parents who are concerned, or grandparents concerned, about their child's financial education.
Well, I know that folks are going to absolutely want to pick up another copy. Do you recommend they try Barnes & Noble, maybe Amazon.com?
Well, whatever is closest to them. I would encourage them to support their local Barnes & Noble, or better yet, their local bookstore, because those guys are struggling and they need help. So support your local economy.
Welcome back, Steve Forbes.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
Although 50 million people qualify for food stamps and most households receive some form of government assistance, according to the Census Bureau, nearly half of Americans are either at or near the poverty level. Is this due to a flaw in the capitalist system, or is it primarily a result of big government and overregulation?
You put your finger on it, an environment that is hostile to free enterprise. Free enterprise, free markets, which are people allowed to do things, create things, take risks, expand businesses, fail, rise up again, is how we've achieved the highest standard of living in human history. And today we have the obstacles of a weak dollar, overspending by government because that takes resources from you, tax code, and the major uncertainties of Obamacare.
Currently, only 7% of Americans, if you can believe this number, are classified as self-employed, the lowest figure in our national history. Isn't the entrepreneur the backbone of capitalism? And if so, how can the system be sustained without that spirit?
Well, one of the reasons that America has grown faster than other developed nations, traditionally grown much faster than Western Europe, we've been growing in the last 20 years much faster than Japan, is precisely because we create new entities, new small companies today that become the big companies of tomorrow. And when you have a hostile environment to that entrepreneurial spirit, with regulations that force banks not to make as many loans to small businesses, new startups, then you get a semi-stagnant economy. We're like a car on an open highway going 40 miles an hour, and we should be going 70 or 80.
It makes one wonder if our regulators and legislators have forgotten that big businesses all began as small businesses.
Take the 1970s, which were a horrible decade, terrible inflation and ever-rising taxes before Reagan came in. In that decade, look at the little things that were coming up that became the big things of tomorrow. Apple, Microsoft, Oracle, Amgen, Southwest Airlines, FedEx. And if you hadn't had the benign environment that Reagan created and that lasted through the early part of the last decade, those companies would have had stunted growth.
What would you suggest, then, to restore and encourage small business?
Well, I think you need several things. One is a benign tax code. We need lower tax rates and a drastically simpler tax code so that people can focus on real things. You know, we spend 6.5 billion hours, and this number comes from the IRS. We spend more than 6 billion hours a year filling out tax forms. That's the equivalent of over 3 million full-time jobs. We also have overspending. Where do the resources come from? They come from us, either through taxation, borrowing, or printing of money, which is another form of taxation. And then you have a weak dollar. When you have an uncertain dollar, that makes investing in the future more problematic. You get less of it if you don't know what you're going to get paid back in. We should have learned this from the 1970s. And when you have a peculiar new health system where if you have a growing business and you reach 50 people and you have to decide, do we continue to grow and take on massive new costs, or do we just put a cap on and start another business?
I'm sure you'd agree that earnings and wealth that come from one's own effort and not from the government pay the best dividends. I would even add that nothing seems to breed contempt as quickly as unearned rewards. How can our legislators protect those who truly need assistance while encouraging self-reliance and individual accomplishment?
We did it for almost 200 years before we got the massive growth of big government, having that kind of entrepreneurial environment. Right now, there are plenty of people in Washington who think they have a big government mentality, who think the government should guide the economy and guide the world. So if we make reforms like tying the dollar to gold, having a flat tax so you can do your tax return either with a few keystrokes or on a back of an envelope, almost, when you have patients in control of health care and a little bit of spending restraint, major positive things will happen.
I'd like to shift to your market perspectives. 2013 has rewarded equities investors handsomely. In your estimation, though, is this market enthusiasm becoming overextended?
Well, one hesitates to predict anything on the market because, as Morgan said, J.P. Morgan, it fluctuates. I think what you see unfolding in the market today is anticipation that for all of our current problems, we're going to find ways around them. The economy will be a little better this year than last year, barring a blow up in the Middle East or in Asia. But we're still like that baseball hitter. We've had a slump and now we're hitting 250 when we should be hitting 350.
You've also gone on record in recent years supporting the need to return to a sound money system. Now that the precious metals have clearly released considerable steam, are gold and silver nearing favorable valuation levels?
Well, you should always have a little bit of gold just to as an insurance policy on your portfolio. And if you buy one of those metals, you should not do it with the mind of a trader. Because unless you have a real instinct for it, and despite our egos, 99% of us don't, you will get whipsawed, especially if you buy it on credit, you know, using margin. So see it as an insurance policy, and if it goes down, it usually means the stock market's going up. And if it's going up, it means your stocks are going down. So it's an insurance policy.
Well, recently, many global central banks have demanded the return of stored and leased gold from the vaults of the United States and other Western nations. The trend seems to be picking up steam here, with the Bundesbank asking for most, if not all, of its gold. Of course, France returned its lion's share in just a few weeks' time, but the United States is asking for 7 years to return the bulk of its gold to Germany. Do you have any thoughts on this and what it might foretell?
The key thing to keep in mind about gold is, thankfully, there is so much of it around the world. It's a very hard market to manipulate for more than a day or two. I think in the next few years, we will be going back to a gold standard, perhaps short as 4 years, maybe as long as 8 or 10. But one way or the other, it will happen. For 180 years, we had the dollar linked to gold, and it worked pretty well. And we've seen recently what happens when you don't have it. It's like a clock that doesn't have 60 minutes in a day. The number of minutes change each day. That makes for a very chaotic world.
I think we have begun to see signs of that with the Cyprus event. Investors woke up and on a Monday morning, many of whom thought their funds were safe, but anything over the limit evaporated. And there is considerable talk in Canada and the United States with regard to bail-ins. A very similar situation might occur in the Western world should another credit crisis unfold as we saw in 2008-2009. Do you think investors should be making contingency plans for another MF Global or Cyprus-like event?
Well, it's hard to predict these things, and so I think you have to take the mindset. For your retirement fund, especially if you're in your 40s, early 50s, you're not going to need the money for a number of years. Then you just gear yourself and ride the storm through. Dollar cost averaging, putting in a certain amount each month or each quarter, that's the way to go. For your the other part of your portfolio, you should always have some cash, even when times look good. And then when opportunities rise up, you're in a position to scoop them up. So a little common sense goes a long way, but don't try to be a market timer. That way you just reward your broker, not yourself.
You went on record recently noting that the bond market and perhaps even real estate might be a bit overextended or at least presenting less of an opportunity to investors.
Well, I think bonds are overpriced, and that doesn't mean they can't stay overpriced for a while longer, especially if the Federal Reserve continues to misbehave. But there's no way, given the government's finances, that a 30-year bond should be 3% or a 10-year bond 2%. So it's just a matter of time when that thing unravels. And the other thing you've got to be very careful of is, unless you know a market well, if you're in commercial real estate, is farmland. Farmland has gone up a lot in recent years, doubled. And I just am old enough to remember the 70s when we had this kind of surge. Didn't end very happily. And I think a lot of people are buying hard assets because of the fear of what the Federal Reserve is doing. But as we saw with Ronald Reagan, those periods don't last forever. And the 1980s were a rough time for farmland, for commodities. And so I think investors just got to be aware of that.
So I would guess then that you would say that Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke might make good with regard to increasing interest rates at some point, pulling back on the reins somewhat with regard to stimulus and quantitative easing.
I think there's a possibility of that, particularly if the U.S. economy shows signs of growth. This year, I think we may get up to 3% after the second quarter. I don't think the second quarter is going to be a barn burner. 3% looks good compared to the last 3 years.
3% growth may not look good relative to our past as a nation, but compared to, let's say, Europe, for instance, it's a phenomenal number. Maybe that's part of the influx of funds into our equities markets, global investors looking for higher returns. Anything else that investors should be watching?
I think investors should sometimes do less watching, stick to fundamentals, and if they want to do watching, watch their politicians.
Any contact information, direct folks to pick up a copy of the Freedom Manifesto.
Well, Freedom Manifesto is at your bookstores and on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. It's Freedom Manifesto, Why Free Markets Are Moral and Big Government Isn't. You can follow me on Twitter, Steve Forbes, CEO. And we have a great website, Forbes.com. So we can connect one way or the other.
Very good. Mr. Forbes, we can't thank you enough today for taking time out of your busy schedule for us.
You too, Chris. Thank you.